Broadcasting live statewide from the Civic Media Studios in Green Bay, this is Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, your inside source on everything entertainment from Wisconsin to Hollywood. And now, a guy who gives edible undies as gifts just because they taste good, Pete Schwabba.
Welcome back to hour number two of Nightlight. My good friend Mike Siegel is here. I can see him on the stream, and he's shaking his head at my very funny intro line about giving edible undies as gifts because they taste good. Mike, have you ever been really hungry? Trust me, a nice pair of underwear really, really hits the spot sometimes.
Yeah, what's the best flavor of edible underwear? Do you go strawberry, fruit flavor, or is it like, do they have meat flavors, maybe a bacon? What do you got?
Insert your, no, there's no bacon. There's no beef or bacon. It's just after bars, you know, it all tastes the same, really. But I personally right. really like kiwi. But it's so great to have you here, Mike. Mike Siegel is here. He's a comedian, a host on TV. He hosts his own podcast. You've kind of done it all, Mike. What? Okay, so we were talking about your shows, If Walls Could Talk and What You Get for the Money, which were immensely popular homeowner shows that people that owned homes like to watch. What, you're a homeowner or were a homeowner?
Did you? I was a homeowner.
You
yeah.
were a home. I know you just sold your building recently, but did you learn a lot from those shows?
You know what happened to me? When I had my property, I had a duplex for about 10 years, and that was my first home that I ever bought. And at first, as soon as I got it, I was hooked on all the HGTV shows. You know, you just keep it going. I didn't realize also until I was on it that people tend to leave it on a loop. They just leave it on all day.
Oh, really?
Because it's very, it's very quiet. It's very, it's not offensive. It's just kind of background noise in a lot of people's
homes. Yeah, it is really mellow, a comfort type thing.
Yeah. That's it's like, yeah. But then I would, get hooked on to this thing or that thing. And I'd see, oh man, maybe I should do that with the yard. Or maybe I should paint the room. And then all of a sudden you're spending every weekend in Home Depot. And doing that, after a while, I'm going, it was fine before. What am I doing? And I realized that it just feeds it. And they call it house porn.
Oh, wow.
And it, and you'll see all the ads on there are all for Home Depot or Lowe's or some kind of fix it up thing or some kind of gadget that you may or may not need.
Yeah.
And then
but
once
they'll convince
I,
you need it though.
Yeah, yeah. Once I turned it off, all of a sudden my house didn't seem so bad.
Wait a minute. You don't have a bidet in your one bedroom apartment? What's
I need
okay. that. hey, tell us about you're also an avid traveler. You've been everywhere. And I know that's a huge passion of yours, so much so that you started a podcast called Travel Tales. Tell us about the podcast.
I've been doing that for about since 2011, and it was traveling was always my favorite thing to do. And a lot of my friends were starting podcasts at that time, and I thought, I didn't want to do another one with a couple comics just, bantering back and forth about whatever. But I tried to think of something that I could talk about every day and not get bored of, and that really piqued my interest. And travel was it. And I still do it. It comes out every 2 weeks. We have new guests every 2 weeks. It was never a money-making kind of thing for me, but it did open up a lot of other stuff. In this term of branding that you want as a host, I've hosted not only home shows, but, red carpet celebrity stuff I did on TBS for 9 years on
we'll
a show,
get to that
TBS
too.
Movie Extra there. yeah. And I've hosted music stuff on VH1, game show stuff. So I've been all over the map, but as cable changed, they wanted to experts, quote unquote.
Yeah.
You can't just be a guy traveling around. You got to be a chef or right, you can't just host a home show. You got to be an architect or, whatever,
right.
I mean? So this was another way to kind of brand myself as a travel guy. And it actually kind of led to, not only a whole group of friends that I didn't have before, but into some work of things I taped a special that aired on CNBC, top 10 things to do in Taiwan. Because when you think of Taiwan, Pete, you think of this guy, right? Don't I just Scream Taiwan when you look at me.
Think of my handsome host, half-Jewish friend, Mike Siegel.
Middle-aged white guy. Tell us more about Taiwan. But yeah, it led to that. And I did a lot of media trips to places like Thailand and Croatia and things like that. And it's just been kind of a great experience. And so I met a producer that, you know, I shot local. I still shoot local TV ads here for like the Chevy dealers and things like that. So it did lead to a lot. And then I still haven't gotten tired of doing it. So it's fun to do. And it's, you know, just something it's still a passion of mine. I just got back from Australia. I was there over the holidays, which was great. Ended up doing a little stand-up set out there, which was fun.
Nice. I get to travel vicariously through your Facebook posts. That's how I see the world, is through Mike's pictures. My guest is Mike Siegel. He is the host of the Travel Tales podcast and the former host of If Walls Could Talk and What You Get for the Money. Okay, so I also want to ask you, Mike, you were in a movie called Traffic.
Godfather of Green Bay?
You were in The Godfather
of Green Bay. It's been like 10 minutes since we talked about that piece, so I had to bring it back.
I was going Traffic. I was going to bring in Soderbergh to the conversation. You go back.
I only talked to two directors that I've worked with, Steven Soderbergh and Pete Schwab.
And that's only it. One of us has a radio show, so take that, Soderbergh. What a has-been. So what was it like working? You had a scene with Michael Douglas in the movie Traffic, highly critically acclaimed movie. What was that like?
It was pretty amazing. Like I was like a deer in headlights. You know, I thought when I booked it, I was, you know, this is a big Hollywood movie and the cast is amazing. You know, I just, at that point I had heard about the cast. I knew Soderbergh, and so automatically it was going to be big, but it was not only Michael Douglas. It was Catherine Zeta-Jones. It was Don Cheadle and all these people. And it was really incredible. And I think Benicio del Toro might have won an Oscar for it, or he's at least nominated. I know Soderbergh won the director Oscar for it. But I was like, oh man, I'm going to go on location. I'm going to live in a trailer. All this stuff I heard about, you know, it's going to be great.
I'm going to eat M&Ms whenever I want from the craft services table. Yeah.
And then by the time they got to my day of shooting, I was only in one scene. So I didn't know how long it was going to take. Maybe I'd fly or whatever, because it took place in an airplane. I was in the inside of an airplane.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And it turns out that they shot it on the Universal lot or the Paramount lot or whatever it was. I was there for like a total of two, three hours. And I was like, I think it was like the 50th day of shooting out of 53 days. I mean, they had all been on location. They were all exhausted.
They're gassed.
They're gassed. They're over it. And I just pop in, hey, everybody. And I said, like, you know, and then we wrapped it. We shot. And then I was just like, so was there like a commissary, or is there like, they're like, yeah, there's, you can go buy food over there if you want. I was like, I'm not even getting a lunch out of this.
It's lunch right over there for you. And a free bottle of generic Ralph's water.
I know. But I mean, Michael Douglas was great. And I just thought it was really odd that, you know, Steven Soderbergh, you know, held the camera himself. You know, he DP'd the movie as well, which was common for him. But I guess, you know, the Directors Guild has a problem with it, and probably the Cinematographers Guild. But there was a reason he couldn't be nominated for cinematography and directing.
Wow.
But yeah, he held the camera himself. And I was told then, it's like, yeah, nobody does that. He's the only guy that really kind of does that. But the look of it was amazing. If you see the film again, I haven't rewatched it in a while, but I don't know. My friends don't expect to see me either. They'll pop out of their chair. Is that Siegel?
I've done that with you, like on a network show you've been on. We'll be watching TV and I was like, hey, that's Mike. Like what?
Yeah.
And it's fun to watch stuff or see like my friends that have been in movies when I'm watching stuff in Wisconsin, and I'll go, oh, there's Jamie. And they'll go, you know that guy? It's like the weirdest thing. And I'm like, yeah, he's just a buddy of mine. Like, but so I'm going to give people an idea of the kind of guy Mike Siegel is. So this is kind of cool. I thought when you moved to LA, you got cast in it was a show you were hosting. And, you know, they're dressing you, and I ended up having that experience much later, but they kind of wait on you hand and foot. You're in the green room and they're feeding you and they're fussing over your hair and all this stuff. And, you know, everything in the business, acting, hosting, whatever, it's a lot of waiting around. You just wait and then they call you. And I can't remember if it was one of the producers of The Wardrobe Girl or something said, Mike has just been a doll. He is so patient. He has been such a trooper. I'm like, I look at you and I go, wait a minute, you're just sitting down. Like, you go, I know, I haven't done anything. Like, the crew's running around like maniacs. You're getting paid well. And you're, but it was so cool that you knew that. And you're like, pointed that out even to them. Like, hey, I'm happy to be here, you know.
I think between you and I, who started out in stand-up together, you know, and done so many crap gigs all around, you know, the country, and just eating it everywhere, and just living, you know, hand to mouth and week to week. And when I got something, I was pretty grateful for it. I mean, I didn't, and then you find out later just how many people are high maintenance and things. So, like, when I started traveling for If Walls Could Talk, you know, they had all the stuff in my contract. I had to stay in a certain star level hotel while the crew and the producers were over in at the
Travel Lodge.
With the Hilton. What's the lower, not the Hilton, the medium range Hilton with the free breakfast and stuff like that.
Oh, Hampton or
Hampton Double Inn. Tree, they were at the Hampton Inn. And a lot of times we go to these little small towns around America. The closest, you know, 4-star hotel was miles away.
Yeah.
I could be staying 20 miles away and have to drive extra, and the crew's staying right near where we're shooting. I said, this is ridiculous. I'm by myself over there. This is just dumb. And they went, you'd be willing to stay with us? I was like, yeah, it's fine. It's okay. And then just like, you know, I would, and also the other thing, they were like, do you need somebody to meet you at the airport to walk, you know, we'll, you know, they were spelling everything out and holding my hand from the second I got off the plane. I go, I've done this for years. I'll rent a car and meet you. Yeah. I will get there. You know, you and I,
just give me a place where there's no bed bugs and I'm fine.
Yeah. And this is pre, you know, smartphone really. I mean, they were just starting, but I'll get there. Well, you know,
that's so cool.
I know how to get there, but a lot of people need their handheld and are really.
That's Mike Siegel, folks. He is going to join us again. We got to do this. It's a two-parter. My next guest coming up, Mike, is Dave Patterson, who is the producer of Bridget Terabithia. We ran out of time last week with Dave, so he's back. We're running out of time with you tonight, so Mike is coming back. We're going to have a rotating.
I'll come back another time.
Rotating.
It'll be fun.
Yeah, Dave and Mike. So thanks for your time tonight, buddy. We'll do it again later in the week or next week. But Mike Siegel, everybody.
Wait.
Yeah, all right. Thanks, Mike.
See you, everybody.
That's Mike Siegel, top-notch dude all around, and he will be back soon. Coming up next is Dave Patterson. I'm Pete Schwabe. This is Nightlight on the Civic Media Radio Network. What are you the MacGyver of? It's Richard Dean Anderson's birthday. We had to celebrate. So he was MacGyver, of course, on TV. So we're asking listeners, what are you the MacGyver of? I am the MacGyver of laundry. I can always find something that's barely passable that needs to be washed. Conrad is the MacGyver of useless sports information, and he proved that earlier. Well done, young man.
Thank you.
Todd Alba was the MacGyver of political information.
I think it's actually coffee beans now.
Coffee, yes, you're great point. He's the MacGyver of coffee beans because he owned a coffee shop, so I think that gives him authority to talk like that. And then we just got a text here, too, from the 920. Guess who, Conrad?
I think it's my mom.
Conrad's mom is such an awesome regular texter. I just love it. She said, finding the best deals. That's what she, and you know what? When I first saw this text, I thought she meant, she was talking about If Walls Could Talk, one of the shows Mike hosted, but I think she is talking about, she's the MacGyver of Big, Big Savings.
Yes.
So thank you, Paula. Please continue to text in. We love your texts. Okay. So last week we had a guest on, a good friend of mine who is a wildly popular and successful producer and writer named Dave Patterson. He is the writer and producer of the film Bridge to Terabithia, based on the Newbery Award-winning novel that his mother wrote, which is one of the best books of all time. And we kind of ran out of time with Dave, so I invited him back. And he joins us now on Nightlight. Hey, Dave.
How are we doing, sir?
Good. This is a mini-series officially now. We've made it I think it's every week now, buddy. You got to keep churning out movies so we have stuff to talk about.
I've done a lot of minis in my life, so I think we're good with that.
All right. We won't go into too many details there.
Let me just jump in right off.
Yeah.
The MacGyver. I am the MacGyver of the running toilet.
The running? Okay.
The running toilet, right? We all have running toilets in our house.
We jiggle the handle. What do you do?
Well, you got to clean out the flush button. You know when the drum opens and the little thing closes?
Okay.
If there's any gitchy stuff around where the thing drops, you got to clean that out. Just scrub it out. So it when it drops down onto that little hole thing, that stops it from running. If you have crud around the hole, I guess everyone's learning this, crud around the hole.
Or gitchy stuff.
It does not close up. So I am the MacGyver of toilet flushing.
Does your wife appreciate that knowledge you just shared with our listening audience?
Having two boys at home for 20 plus years, yes.
There you go.
Getting a toilet to flush and stay flushed is really important.
It sure is. It's something you take for granted, but once it goes haywire, your life changes.
Not with children. Yeah. Anyone out there with children know a running toilet is the devil incarnate.
We have had some really strange MacGyverisms tonight, and they're a wide array. I love that one. That might be my favorite so far.
So, I got more, but yeah. Go ahead.
Well, we got a lot to get to because we ran out of time last week, and I want to kind of bring you back to Bridge to Terabithia because that's kind of where we got caught off. I felt like I had to cut one of your stories short. Just to give listeners, you know, some background, Dave is the writer-producer of the film Bridge to Terabithia. His mom wrote the book. And can you tell us again a little bit of background about that book, Dave, and how your relation to it?
Well, many people are very familiar with the book.
Yeah.
What many people don't know is based on a real story. When I was 7 years old, I met a girl who I thought was immediately my best friend and I thought maybe my life mate. And just 9 months later, she was tragically killed. And it devastated both families, both my family and the girl's name was Lisa Hill, her family. And my mother, who had started writing books, she chose to write a story about the tragedy for herself, as therapy for herself. And she told everyone, I did not write this for David, I wrote it for myself. And when she presented it to her her editor said, you know, you have to publish this. And she said, well, I don't know if anyone will get this story. And her publisher said, everyone will get this story. Wow. And so she said, well, I have to get David's permission. And so my mother, whose career was basically set on her son's permission, she said, could you read the book and can I publish it? And I said, well, yes, you can. But in the dedication, it's just dedicated to me. And it has to be dedicated to Lisa as well. And so anyone who has the book, actually go out and buy the book, because then my mother will get a nickel. It's dedicated to me and my best friend who passed away. And it's and part of the dedication, I said that last week, my mother says bonsai, which in Japanese means may you live 1,000 years. And what we know now that the book has lasted for 50 years and maybe it will live for 1,000 years if people continue to read it. So
last week I shared a story. I had Dave was going to come to Marinette, Wisconsin, Little Marinette. They allotted every so often a budget to bring authors in, and they did. And for whatever reason, they stopped it that year. And I still don't know the whole reason. I was pretty furious because I was looking forward to hanging out with you. But what a great opportunity for the kids to meet someone that the book was based on. And you were such a top-notch guy too, Dave. When my daughter was in fifth grade, you, I think before Zoom, maybe it was Skype, you talked to her whole class about the book they were reading. And I read the book with her at the time, so I knew what she was reading. And because of your connection to it, I wanted to read it. But I just think that's such a cool thing. Do you do that often? Actually, just talk to a small group of kids? That's got to fill up your day.
You know what? I do, because the simple fact is, and I don't know how to say it any other way, is I am Terabithia. I am Terabithia.
Wow.
what my life is was based on what happened to me as a child. And so when people want to ask me questions, I'm willing to talk about it because, look, we all have had tragedies in our lives. We've all had devastating things happen to us in our lives. And so many don't recover from it. Right. And I'm not going to say I recovered from it, but I was able to survive it. And when I talk to kids today, they ask me, when did you get over it? And I said, I never got over it.
Yeah.
I never got over it. It's sort of like when someone, I say, when someone sees a scar on you, they're like, that's a really cool scar. How'd you get that? They don't know the pain involved to that scar. They don't know the history of that scar. But you have that scar and you're willing to talk about it. And so that's really the issue. That's why I want to talk to kids, is that a lot of these kids have had very bad things happen to them as well. And I want to let them know. I'm a super old guy.
You're much older than me.
Yeah, we know that. We discussed that last.
That's right.
But literally, I was cut down in my prime at 8 years old, and I managed to continue to live. And I think that's a very important thing for kids to know, that you will be hit with things that you think will stop your life or stop your existence, but you can continue on. I talk at a lot of film festivals and writing things about triumph over tragedy. And, you know, I became an artist because of what happened to me as a child. And I was able to use a lot of that pain.
Dave, let's pick up right there. I want to continue. That's so great for kids. Coming up next, more with Dave Patterson. Just great stuff. This is Pete Schwabe and Nightlight on the Civic Media Radio Network. Texter from the 608 says, I'm the MacGyver of combing my hair. I don't really know what that means, but it's not as cool as the MacGyver that Dave Patterson represents when he fixes his toilet. Dave joins us. He is back for more. Week number two of this mini-series with Dave Patterson, writer and producer of Bridge to Terabithia. So we'll move on, Dave. I have one more question about the Bridge to Terabithia, which we could talk about all night, but
sure.
What are you still in touch with Lisa's family? And how are they doing?
My mother is still in touch with the family. I'm in touch with a sister. It was just like in the book and the movie. It destroyed both families. And the parents of her family divorced. And the brother and sisters were devastated by it. It was a very, very rough time. One thing that the sister reached out to me actually it was about 5 or 6 years ago, is when they were going through the house they were moving out of, they found Lisa's diary from when she was a kid.
Oh my gosh.
And a month before she passed away, she wrote in her diary, I love David Patterson, and he loves me too.
Dear God.
And she died less than a month after that. And her sister shared that with me. And as I mentioned, we were very young kids. We were 8 years old, 7 years old.
That's so sweet. Yeah.
So I certainly never imagined love at that point in my life. But for her to write that in a diary, and she shared this with me. Of course, I lost it when I got that, you know. Yeah. And I asked her if I could have the diary. She said, no, it's mine. It was the sister. She goes, I need to keep this diary. But, you know, she sent me a picture of the diary. It's actually around the corner, but I'm not going to, like, grab it and stuff like
yeah.
that. But, you know, it was an unbelievable lifetime experience, which has now touched millions upon millions of people's lives. And, you know, it's about childhood innocence and childhood love.
Yeah. Okay, I lied. I have two more quick questions about Bridge to Terabithia.
Okay.
One, you were the writer-producer of the movie. I love right. the story you told me before. You wrote it, and oftentimes it's happened to me, they replace writers on movie projects. They just do. They bring in fresh eyes and whatever. So you as a producer have a funny story about the writer being something happening with the writer. So I'd love for you to tell that. And then I want to ask you how your mom felt about the movie. So you can answer those in whatever order you see.
Sure, I'll do it as fast as possible because I know you're under a time constraint. But, you know, when I started making movies and you and I made movies at the same time in festivals and stuff yeah. like that, I said, you know, this is a family movie, so I'm going to protect it. I'm not going to just give away the property. And so I met with major studios early on. They're like, just give us it. We'll give you a bunch of money. And I said, no. Yeah. I said, I want to be the writer and producer. And I would meet with the same companies. They said, all right, how about we'll make you a producer, but not the writer, and go away. We'll give you a bunch of money. I went, no, I'm a writer and producer. Because I knew the day that they bought the property, I would be kicked off as a writer. And so I wanted to be at least attached as a producer to try to guide it through, because it yeah. was a family story. It was something to protect. So my favorite story is I get a deal with Disney. Disney's going to hate this story. I fly to LA for my first big meeting. There's like 20 people in this room. Big head walks in. He goes, all right, let's talk about the new writer. Room goes quiet. All these heads look around, they look at me, and then they look at the head guy. He goes, well, someone told David he's been replaced as the writer, right? And I'm at the end of the table, literally the end of the table. I raise my hand like, no, no one told me I was replaced. They're like, well, but Dave, you're still a producer, so that's cool. We got these great writers that are going to fix your work, and we're going to make it brilliant. And that's the other thing, you're jumping early. In Hollywood, what they say is, we love your property. It's yeah. brilliant. And this is how we're going to fix it.
Right.
And so with Bridge, they brought on two different writers, paid them $1 billion more than me, and then brought me back on to rewrite it, to fix it, but for no additional money because I was—
because you're a producer.
To do it. Yeah. And so, but the reason I attached myself as a writer-producer is because I wanted to keep literally a fish hook in the property.
Yeah.
To make sure that someone would guide it to its end and not really offend either my family or my best friend's family.
That's so great. And I mean, you pulled it off, so that's fantastic. And that's what they do. They buy a script and they tell you it's perfect, and then they read it over and over and over. And naturally, you're going to change stuff when you do that. So was your mom happy with the movie?
My mother was beyond the stars happy with it.
Oh, that's nice.
Because she knew that I would protect it. And literally, you know, when people saw the advertisements for it, it was Disney. So it was all the CGI special effects. And people were like, that was in the book. I'm not going to go see the movie. That's BS. I'm not going to do it. And I suspected that would be the case. But then when people saw the movie, they went, actually, it's almost just like the book. Don't trust the advertisements. Don't trust the CGI. And that's really when people came to see it. They came to see it the second weekend. First weekend, no one went to see it because they're like, oh, it's BS. It's not the book. And then second weekend, I was like, actually, it is. And thank God the reviewers who are familiar with the book said, it is. It's dead on. And a quick story. I know we got all this. They took my mother and gave her— they sat her down and they did three different
screenings, test screenings?
No, not the screenings, but the trailers to lead it.
Okay.
And so they say, in the world of children not being happy and imaginations, like, so they did these horrible trailers for Bridge to Terabithia with nothing had to do with the book. And after they shoot all three, my mother, when they raised the blinds and stuff, my mother goes, well, I'm glad David talked to me because he said they were awful. And they are. and they were, but they were trying to go after a different audience. Right. And not the people who read the book. And now me as a producer, I understand that. Because if everyone who read the book went to see the movie, we would have lost money. The idea was to get everyone,
new people,
to come see the movie. And so is there a little false advertising involved with that? Yeah.
You got to get the butts in the seats.
That's what show business is about. And so the idea was for people who had no idea about the book to come see and go, hey, it's a pretty good book. And tell, I mean, pretty good movie, and tell everyone that. Right. So, you know, it's,
that's so great. My guest is David Paterson, the writer and producer of the movie Bridge to Terabithia, which is based on his mother's Newbery Award-winning classic novel. So let's talk about, you know, you're like this accomplished writer, even aside from your mom's book. You and I met at, and we talked a little bit about your new project, but I want to ask you, the film that familiarized me with your work was a film that we met at the New York Film Festival. You had a film there called Love Ludlow that I just thought was great. Can you tell us what happened with that? Where can people see it? Because I'm recommending it. I think it's a great little film.
All right. So this is where tragedy strikes.
Uh-oh.
So let's tweak it. So it is an incredible film that should be seen by a bazillion people, right?
Yeah.
And you can, if you go on Amazon, you can order the DVD and stuff. And this is what drives me crazy, that you can get Godfather on Green Bay everywhere. But we shot the movie on such a low budget. We shot it for 75 grand.
Whoa, really?
But there's a crazy thing. We shot it on film way back when, because we had the film donated. But to make a master for the film festival release, we had to do it to digital. And so during the transfer, what I since found out, there was what's called a what's the word? It is
down conversion.
Well, what it is, it is a suicidal transfer, which means something happens during the transfer that corrupts it to the point that it cannot be used in the future. Now, when we did this way back when, because I sold it to Starz, I sold it to Sundance, all the technology was very basic back then. So no one noticed this critical transfer where an additional, you know, frames per minute, right? You know, when you do an additional frame was in. It's like 4 frames per minute, but there was 5 frames per second or whatever.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until we tried to bump it up to digital release that those things could not accept it. Oh, and those guys went, by the way, you have a corrupted, product.
Master.
Yeah. Because you have 5 frames per second as opposed to 4, which is normal. And so literally, because this is a couple of years ago, I said, I'm going to put it on like you, put it on streaming and stuff like that. And they went, no, you have a corrupted master. And I'm like, well, how do I fix that? Like, well, you have to go back to all your original things, and you have to do a new master. And the technology has since passed. So this is what I do tell young filmmakers, is whatever you've done in 2 years, make it the next technology.
Yeah, right.
2 years later, make it the next technology. Right. Oh, Fatal Flaw. It was called Fatal Flaw Transitioning. That's what it was called.
Yikes.
And it's a show business term. It's that the fact is, if the technology is slightly off, you cannot transfer it to the next level of technology.
It's a chore. Like when I had to transfer The Godfather of Green Bay just to get it on 3 years ago, it took months to track down elements. I had to use a lot of my own money to do it, but I was sick of telling people, they'll say, where can I watch it? I'm like, well, it's if you have a DVD it's a nightmare. So
They told me basically to do it. It would cost me $100,000 to make it now workable for streaming.
Just reshoot it. Yeah.
Let's just say I didn't make that much money overall down the road. I mean, I made a couple dollars, but I know to spend $100,000 to transfer it, to try to make $100,000 profit, it ain't gonna happen.
Well, we recently cleaned out our garage recently, and I found my copy of Love Ludlow among many other things I had in storage of other movies. So if I can help Dave in any way, if that single copy that you gifted me and signed, I'm happy to I'm happy to contribute that.
I want all your listeners to buy the DVD on Amazon.
There you go.
It's secondhand sales. Actually, I don't get a dime out of it. But just for someone else that enjoy Love, Love, Love.
Right. Because you know, talk about those, who you had a great cast. It was the girl from Roseanne and the guy from Sex and the City.
Alicia Goranson.
Alicia Goranson. That's right. I always forget her name.
Alicia Goranson, who's doing very well. And David Eichenberg, who was from Sex and the City. He's now in Chicago Fire.
Yeah.
And they, you know, I don't like to say anyone's in my movie has done very well afterwards, but yeah, anyone's been in my movies has done very well afterwards.
you're the springboard.
I am. I and also will say every elementary school or high school I went to was torn down soon after I left, but you know, people benefited from that as well. So,
okay. So when we have to take a minute, we don't, you know, don't lose your train of thought, because I want to ask you about, have you seen a lot of the Oscar movies? The list just came out today for the Oscar nominations.
Honestly, I have not seen a lot of them.
Okay.
Because, again, as a member that votes for a lot of things, they used to actually send you DVDs.
Oh, that was the best. Yeah, they would send you all the movies.
Remember that?
Yeah.
And now they send you links, okay, to put it on your phone. Which, by the way, I'd like to watch it with my wife, but I'm not going to sit with my wife on a phone. We like each other, yeah. But we don't want to be that close. Okay?
And you have a flip phone, too, so that doesn't work. So
exactly.
So let's talk about that, too. Coming up next is more with Dave Patterson. This is a fun night here at Nightlight. I'm Pete Schwabba. This is the Civic Media Radio Network. Vegas. Why are these lights so bright? Welcome back. On this day in 1942, the film Casablanca was released. My guest is David Patterson right now. And I can see on the stream, the walls of your office, you have a Casablanca poster. Three months ago, Dave, I saw it for the first time all the way through. I'd always seen parts. I love that movie so much.
It is a great, great film.
And it holds up. Like, I just want to go hang out at Rick's American Cafe in Morocco or whatever. You know, it's so amazing.
And in its simplicity, that's the simple thing. You know, you talk about subplots, blah, blah, blah. It was just a good story.
Yeah.
It's very well done.
It's like they got a guy, I think there's like a 4 or 5 minute stretch where the guy's just playing the piano and everybody's listening and moving. It's like, that's a scene in the movie. Like, you couldn't do that nowadays. People are like, what is this? You know, but then you got a spy deal happening over there at the cafe, then Humphrey Bogart walking around. It's just the energy of it. It's so great. And so I love that poster. I got to get myself one of them. So, okay, so you live outside New York, and you've been to L.A. several times. Obviously, we've met out there. I used to live out there, and I always loved when you would come to town, but what do you think it's helped you as a writer? Because I feel more inspired now that I'm not in LA sometimes, that I'm in Wisconsin now. Are you more inspired living outside New York City, or sometimes do you wish you had moved to LA? Where are you at as a writer from an inspiration standpoint?
All right. So the simple fact is, once Bridge took off, I was told I had to move to LA. I had to. I was on top of the world. I had to do that.
Right.
I've always been committed. This sounds soppy, whatever. I've always committed to family and friends. And when Bridge took off, I was already a stay-at-home dad. I was in charge of two small boys. My wife traveled 200 to 250 days a year. And that's what she did. That's what she did. And so I committed to stay home with the kids. And so for me, it wasn't an option. Yeah, it was great. I had a great movie, but I was not going to move to LA. I was going to make it work from where I was. And
good for you.
immediately there was the writer's strike of 2008, right after I had a very successful film. And, you know, things happen, right? Things happen. And so, but my objective in my life as an artist was never, I'm sorry, it makes me sound great, but it was never about me. It really was about the choice I made with my wife, my life, and my children. And I wanted to be in show business, but show business was not about me. And so I didn't take the road that most people would do. And, you know, this, I started as an actor. I was an actor and a stuntman early on before we had children. And I was on a soap opera. And then when we decided to have children, I said, I'm going to leave the soap opera because how difficult could raising children be? I've since learned actually it's really difficult. And Pete knows I used to be 6'9" and I'm 5'8" now. So staying home with children does kill you.
Staying home with children costs you your ability to dunk.
Exactly. Yeah. But you know what? I just wanted to have a life and I chose not to go. And you did that too in a lot of ways. You made priorities of life. That life, wife, and family, it's not nearly as important as the golden ring of show business. Right?
Absolutely. I think when you have kids, you're never going to regret that. No one ever says, I wish I didn't have kids, unless they're like a sociopath.
Exactly.
But
no.
You're right. You make concessions and it might've cost me a few bucks, but I don't care. It's maybe it didn't, maybe it helped me. I don't know, but you don't give up the
whether
experience.
Whether it cost you bucks, does it cost you joy?
Right.
I think that's the most important thing.
I'm still trying to figure out a way to monetize joy. I have not done that yet, Dave, but that I think we should go into business and try.
Well, I've talked to my wife about joy and sex, and again, not able to monetize that in any way at all with her.
She doesn't pay you for sex? What's going on there? Oh, man.
I'm just trying to monetize it. And anyway, she's if she hears this, I'm be in a lot of trouble.
You're going to owe a lot of money.
But no, I mean, my entire life is literally about family, security, and it was never about fame.
Yeah.
Fame would be great, right? But it's not about that. And anyone in the show business who thinks fame is their ultimate goal, they're going to end up unhappy and hungry on any given
day. Usually don't last that long either. You have to have a passion for being creative and the creative arts to sustain, because it's really about the journey. And you appreciate that. No one just gets famous unless they develop an appreciation somehow for whatever it is they're doing. But hey, we got to wrap up here, Dave. But I know the Oscar nominations came out today. Have you seen any of the films? Can you recommend any?
Well, you saw that on my Facebook. I freaking love Barbie.
Yeah.
And people are going to give me grief about it. But the fact is, if you read the script, I'm not just talking about the colors and the sparkling stuff, about what women have to get through to achieve anything in life. I watched my wife do that in the corporate world, and it is dead on accurate. Okay. It is dead on. And so I find it so funny that the director was not nominated.
How is that possible? Here's what I equated to. Okay. A few years ago, George Miller makes Mad Max Fury Road. All these peripheral Oscars roll in, but he doesn't get best director. The guy who brought it all together. It's the same thing with Greta Gerwig. She created this world and brought these great.
She wrote it too. She wrote it.
Yeah,
too.
I do not get that at all. And Margot Robbie's great. Okay, maybe she didn't get nominated, but then you nominate Ryan Gosling. Like, how did she not? None of it makes sense. I don't get it, but I guess it's fun to talk about. So
I'm just going to say it's a male world.
Yeah.
You know what? I'm sorry. And I'm a male and I should enjoy that, but I'm just telling you, not so much.
Do you tell yourself like I do that we're one of the good ones?
I tell my wife all the time I'm one of the good ones.
Come on, honey.
I don't get sex from that, but I still tell her that I'm one of the good ones. So
I can't help you there, buddy. Hey, I do appreciate your time though, Dave. You're the best. Thank you so much for coming back for a second week. We'll do it again. I hope. We always find stuff to talk about. All right. Have a great night. Thanks, Dave.
Good night, all.
David Patterson. So much fun to talk to. David Patterson, part two, the sequel. That's what we did here. And he is, I love the way he talks about show business and grounding himself and all that kind of stuff. And if Love Ludlow is ever available, I recommend it highly. And his new film is, which we didn't get to, is The Girl Who Wore Freedom. That will be available soon if you Google that, a documentary about World War II veterans. Really interesting stuff. I'd like to thank all my guests today. Todd Albaugh stopped by. He's great. Mike Clemens gave us an update in the Bucks. My buddy Mike Siegel was here. And Dave Patterson, a very full show of Nightlight tonight. I hope you join me again tomorrow. I'm Pete Schwabe. This is the Civic Media Radio Network. Good night, Wisconsin.
Yeah.